Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very pleased to be here tonight, even though I don't know where I am or how I got here. But actually, I'm rather comfortable with that, not knowing where I am or how I got here. I've spent half my life that way. But I'd like to thank Mike for asking me up here. And if I totally bomb, he wants me to tell you that it's actually Matt's fault that I'm here. So one of those two is the person to blame. I've had a very good day. I got up at 4 a.m. this morning to get on a plane to come up here after about 3 hours worth of sleep. And it's a beautiful, beautiful day in San Francisco. I had to switch planes in San Francisco, and it was just a beautiful flight over here. And as I was driving by to find my hotel, I looked at the little schedule that Mike had sent me and realized that it was about 10 o'clock and I could catch the 10:30 meeting. I came in and heard Kenny, and he gave a great, great talk, and I really enjoyed it. And then I went and I slept until now. So that's what I've been doing in your town of Ripon, is listening to Alcoholics Anonymous and sleeping. That's what I've been doing. So I'm going to just rifle right into it. I need to find this watch that I borrowed from Randy so that I can keep track of this. It's kind of a late starter in life in drinking. I did not start drinking until I was 11. Kind of late these days, actually. I've been at meetings where guys are 12 years old taking a 90-day chip, and they got one hell of a story going on already. I'm like, whoa. But at 11 years old, I took my first drink, and I didn't know it at the time, and I didn't know it until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and understood what alcoholism was. I believe I was an alcoholic right from the gate because of what happened to me over the next 12 hours after I took my first drink. What happened was my parents were out of town for the weekend. I stole a bottle of wine from my father. I locked myself in his study, and I proceeded to drink. And halfway through that first bottle of wine, I got this feeling that, well, I don't even need to describe it in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys know what that feeling is. But, man, it was better than anything I had ever experienced in that first 11 years of my life. I just remember as it went down, I just like, oh. I remember taking this big, deep breath, just, now I didn't know I'd been short of breath for the first 11 years of my life. I didn't know that, but I was breathing easier now. And that's the last thing that I remember of that night was that feeling. And the next thing that I remember is I came to my bedroom, and it was the next day, and there was puke everywhere. I mean, all over the walls, all over the floor, in the pillowcase, in my underwear, I mean everywhere. And I knew I was going to have to puke again, and I made it into the bathroom, realized I'd puked all over the bathroom floor. I slipped on the bathroom floor, hit my head on the toilet bowl going down, and as I crawled back up to get my head back in the toilet bowl, I felt that wonderful, wonderful feeling that I would feel many times later in my life. And that is how nice and cold that porcelain feels next to your face. And I got my head back in that toilet bowl, and I started to heave, and I'd made it into the dry heave stage. You know that, right? Where nothing but phlegm is coming out. And I was right at that point, and all of a sudden my mind started talking to me. And my mind said this: this is all right. We're going to do this again. So right there, within 12 hours of taking my first drink, everything that makes me alcoholic happened. Halfway through that first bottle of wine, I got an abnormal, or the book calls it, an allergic reaction to alcohol. This strange thing called the phenomenon of craving kicked in, and I lost control over the amount that I drank. I only meant to sort of experiment, to see what alcohol was about. I did not mean to drink two bottles of wine at 11 years old. I did not mean to. And this thing called the phenomenon of craving is the best way I can describe that phenomenon of craving in my life is that I seem to get thirstier the more I drink. It's just absolutely bizarre. I have a bottle of water up here tonight. Cost me two tickets. Right? And I'm probably going to finish maybe half of it, or might even finish the whole thing as I'm talking to you over the next hour or so. However, when I leave here tonight, I am not going to be stopping by the store to buy two cases of water to get me through the rest of the night. I'm not going to do it. But if it was booze, I guarantee you, that hotel that Mike put me up is only about 4 miles away. I wouldn't get back there till tomorrow morning. It's just a strange thing. Once I start drinking, the best way I can say it is I get thirstier the more I drink. But if that's all that made me alcoholic, is that when I drank, I would lose control over the amount that I drink, well then, you guys would get together once a year for this unity thing, and somebody would get up and say, remember what Nancy Reagan say? said, just say no, and we'd all go, just say no. And we'd go on and live the rest of our lives, no problem, no, you know, just, you know, we'd call each other maybe once every few weeks and say, remember, just say no, right? But it doesn't seem to be that way, does it? And there's this strange thing called the mental obsession. And right there, that very next morning, as I'm puking my guts out, my mind was able to rationalize and justify that and set up a series of lies to say, you got to get back to that feeling you had last night. You got to get back there. And my mind was able to rationalize and justify. I mean, right there, that particular morning at 11 years old, I'm paying not too big of a price, just a little sick, kind of puking, no big deal. But later on in my life, my mind would be able to rationalize and justify handcuffs as a momentary, temporary inconvenience. That's the way my mind would put that. When the truth is that handcuffs are actually a symbol from society that says, we don't even trust you at all with your own hands. So anyway, I started drinking alcoholically right from the gate, right there at 11 years old, as much as I could, as often as I could. And before I started drinking, I was like this goofy kid, short hair, playing violin, doing really well in school, loved my family. Once I started drinking, everything changed. Out went the violin, in came the heavy metal guitar, wanted to grow my hair down to my ass. School became a very secondary issue, and my parents became the enemy immediately. A lock went on my bedroom door, black lights went up in my room, posters went up, my gods became Jimmy Page and Ritchie Blackmore, and my parents were just going, wow! Right? Now that was we lived in Seattle at that time, and at least I did, my family is still there. That was a summer of going into seventh grade, and a typical morning in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Every school's got a Loser's Corner out there. And we would be out there, and we would, any morning that we possibly could, we would have what I like to call the playground cocktail. It would be a jar with a whole mixture of the parents' liquor cabinet, right? And we didn't know what was in there. We weren't connoisseurs yet. There would be an equal amount of whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth. There'd be green things floating around in that. And you can imagine about 5 or 6 12-year-olds handing that around and choking on it. And of course, it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. You remember that stuff? And it was even before Ziploc days when it would just be a regular Glad bag. And as you'd roll it up, there'd be about 9 people spit on it. Anyway. And we'd pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if we were really desperate that morning, it would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. My eyes kind of fog up when I just even think about it. We pack all those seeds and stems and leaves in there. We hit that lighter around. The seeds and stems would be popping. We'd be burning holes in our clothes. And then we'd look at each other and go like, do we go to school today? Like, no. 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 Now, it's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous often interrupt themselves and say something like this. I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are part of my story. I think it's a bizarre thing for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. I just think it's a strange thing. I understand apologizing to police officers. I understand apologizing to parents. But I don't understand apologizing to other alcoholics. You know, the most bizarre example I've ever seen of that, I was in a speaker meeting much like this a few years ago, and a speaker was up just giving one of the most heinous, ugly, blow-by-blow drunk logs I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm in a speaker meeting and the drunk-a-log gets ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. I think that night I was on the edge of my chair drooling and going, go, 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 go. And at one point in this ugly story, this guy said, you know, I had 4 DUIs, and the judge said if I got one more DUI, I was going to go to prison for sure. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, I'm on the freeway in a blackout. I hit a family of 4. They all wound up in the hospital, and I wound up in prison. And in prison, I sodomized men. I was sodomized, and, oh, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs, too. I was the only one that thought that was strange that night. So anyway, by the time I was 14, I was a neighborhood drunk and a neighborhood drug dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. I wish he would have been chuckling like you. My father was not laughing about any of this. And my parents, very, very good people. And they saw me withering away in front of their eyes. I mean, before I started drinking, I had a vocabulary. Now, by the time I'm 14, my hair is down in front of my face. Can't even see my eyes when they were. When you could see my eyes, they were just bloodshot red as could be. And my vocabulary was, wow. Whoa. Man. I'd call my mother man. That's what I would do. And you know, they tried their best. I mean, but you see, the thing is, they always blame my problems on people, places, and things. They always thought if we can get him away from that damn group of kids he's hanging out with, things will get better. If we can get him out of that damn public school system, things will get better. But you see, the thing is, my problem, I'm an alcoholic. My problem is not people, places, and things. My problem is my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. See, all that happens if you change the people, places, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. But I mean, I can't blame them. So anyway, by the time I was like 17, almost 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle. And my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. If we can get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me across state to Washington State University, about 300 miles away, and I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and I got about 10 credits is what I got. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content. About a 0.25. Now, I'm not talking about a 2.5. That would be a C average. I've actually been, like, proud of that. I would have framed that. Talking 0.25, that is like withdrawals, incomplete F, and an occasional D, maybe like in a bowling class or something. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. They would send out a big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. The first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. And the second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year. And that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in marketing. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest as a marketing director. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. And she's a very happy young woman. We're very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in advertising. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's about ready to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou who works for, this was a while ago, mind you, he's about ready to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. And they love to travel together. They love to golf together. He's a very happy young man. We're very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. I mean, what are they supposed to put in their Christmas letter? He was arrested twice this year, destroyed the house when we were out of town. You know, that's all they could have put. Oh. It's about this same time that, you know, just one more thing, one more wrecked car, one more time getting arrested or something, I forget. But my folks have said, you know what, we've had it up to here. We've tried again and again and again to help you, and all you've ever done is spit in our face. If you're going to live that way, go ahead, but not around here. We don't want to see you anywhere around here. Just go. And so I packed up my car that was sitting in the driveway, and I headed south. Now, my cars, I'd had a lot of cars ever since I'd been 16 years old, and they always started out as perfectly good used cars, but they would die of alcoholism along the way. I don't know if your cars did that, but mine did. And this will tell you exactly why I drank. If I were physically sober on any given morning, meaning I just haven't had a drink yet that day, and I'm a little restless, irritable, and discontent, and I come out of wherever I happen to be living, whether it be my parents' basement or a park, depending on what part of my life we're talking about. And I'm a little restless, irritable, and discontent, just generally pissed off. When I didn't have a drink in me, that's the best way to describe me. Just generally pissed off is what I am. And I'd walk up to a car that I'd owned for a while, and I'd see the dents and the broken windows. I'd be madder. Man, I deserve better than this. And I'd get in, and I'd smell the rancid smell of stale alcohol on the carpets. I'd see the cigarette and hot box burns on the seat. And I'd turn that key, and it's only hitting on one or two cylinders. And I'd be looking through a cracked windshield, and the rearview mirror's hanging off. And I'd be driving down the road. Some young guy would blaze by me in a nice car, honking at me, and damn it, I'm just a little edgy here. And all I'd have to do is go drink for a couple of hours. And after I would drink for a couple of hours, I'd walk back up to that very same car. Now as I'd approach that car, I'd say to myself, why, that 62 Dodge Coronet, that's a classic. And I'd get in and it wouldn't smell bad anymore. Then the most miraculous thing I ever experienced prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous would happen when I turned that key. Now after drinking for a couple of hours, I would turn that key and it would like, boom, it's like a mechanic had been working on my car while I'd been drinking. Literally the way this thing corners at 70 miles an hour. And so I'd wonder why I'd wind up in jail, you know. Anyway, I headed south. I lived out of the car, lived at Portland, Santa Cruz, streets of Hollywood. The words are demoralizing. Long story short, I'm back up in the Seattle area about a year and a half later, and a drug deal goes very, very badly. So badly that I joined the Navy. It went that badly. Just one of those nights, you know. What I'm about to tell you should scare the daylights out of you, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test that qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should scare the daylights out of you that the Navy was even thinking possibly, maybe, or even remotely have any idea about putting somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base, and I could not pass that test. It's called a urinalysis test is what it's called. So I was immediately kicked out of the nuclear engineering group and transferred to this group that they affectionately called nuclear waste is what they called us. And I'll never forget that day in boot camp. We were in boot camp probably about 2 or 3 weeks before the original urinalysis test came back. And all of a sudden one morning the master at arms came in to our barracks and started calling off the names. There were probably 5 or 6 names on that list and my name was on there. And they told us to come with him. And so we were marched out and put into this van and taken to another side of the base, and they pulled up in front of this administrative building, and all the other guys were told to get out, and I was told to stay in the van. I was like, what on earth? So they were taken in there. The driver came back and took me to another building and then marched me right into this office. It was a commanding officer's office. He was in charge of the whole Great Lakes Naval Station. Taken into this office, had a very plush carpeting, oak desk there, lots of pictures of ships, and there's a guy sitting behind that desk with lots of gold, so much gold it almost hurt your eyes. And they marched me in front of this guy, and he asked me my name. I told him. And then he had this telephone on his desk with a speakerphone, and he hit this button, and he said, Walt, that's my father's name. And I told you my father was a Lutheran minister. He also had been a reserve chaplain ever since World War II for 40 years. And this was an old friend of his from World War II. And something, due to the way my last name is spelled, which is very abnormal, he decided to look up to see if, by chance, I happened to be his son. And sure enough, there's my father's voice on the other end of that speakerphone, and I'm standing there, and he goes, Walt, I have your son standing in front of me, and he's gone positive for cocaine on the very first urinalysis test. We're supposed to discharge him. What do you think we ought to do? And I heard my father's voice over that speakerphone, he said, that is none of my concern. Click. Dial tone. If I could have slithered out of that room underneath that carpet, I would have. I mean, I know now, I had embarrassed my family in the north end of Seattle for years. And now I have embarrassed my father on a national level. Right? Man. And I'll never forget the sound of my father's voice that day. And they kept me in the Navy as a conventional electrician. I didn't stop drinking, so therefore they wouldn't even let me stand watch on a light switch. A year and a half later, I was a lower rank than when I first came in. It's just one of those things. It's see, here's how that could happen. While I was on the ship, I could not deny the fact that I was in the United States Navy. I'm on a big gray ship in the middle of the ocean. I would look around, and I'm in a uniform. I'd look around, see that, my God, the other guy's in the same uniform. Well, I cannot deny the fact that I am in the United States Navy. That ship would pull into a port, and I would take a drink, and I would totally forget that I was in the Navy. And I would come back to where I had last seen the ship when the drunk was over. And sometimes the ship was not there anymore. That is a very lonely feeling on that long pier, as you like. One morning I was driving my car into the base. I'd been drinking all weekend. I had a bottle between my legs, and there's at all military bases, there is a guard shack up front where a Marine will stand duty. And if you're going to park your car on the base, you need to slowly pull up. He'll check your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your windshield. And if everything's in order, he'll let you park on the base. This particular morning, I was late one more time. I was already in a lot of trouble. Driving in, I'd been drinking all weekend. I had a bottle between my legs, and there was a depth perception problem going on. They say it was on my part. I'm not sure. But all of a sudden, I could see the whites of the Marine's eyes, and I looked down at my speedometer. I'm going like 35, 40 miles an hour. I tried to swerve. The car hit this median on the right-hand side and flipped up on its side. Bam! Right through that guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. That morning, the Navy was very angry. They were patching me up at the hospital. They were reading charges on me. This is all nothing new. But the most significant thing that the Navy did that morning is that they put me on medical science's best shot at the alcoholic. It's called antabuse. Yeah. And they gave me a warning. The Navy doctors there gave me a warning about drinking on top of antabuse. I filed that for future reference. I filed that information for later. And they sent that prescription back to the ship's doctor, and every morning I had to show up at sick bay, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour. Over the next couple of weeks, I started to experience what I believe is the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this disease called alcoholism, and that I had developed a mental obsession and a spiritual malady that no human power can can change. I mean, I was sick at the level of my soul and didn't even know it. I remember counting those days that I was on that antabuse, just... It's been about 8 days, and I'm on antabuse. And it's been 10 days, and I'm on antabuse. And it's 11 days, 4 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on antabuse. I started looking around that ship, and the other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. Just kidding. I'm sure you don't do that up here in Ripon. After a couple of weeks of this, I just snapped this one morning. My division officer asked me to do a very legitimate task. I couldn't believe he had asked me to do this lowly thing. I forgot I was the lowest ranking man in the division, but I let him know how I felt. Military officers are very concerned with their subordinates' feelings. So I told him, "You obviously don't know who I am, do you?" And he turned on his heels on me and he stared me down. And to this day, I have never been asked a more embarrassing question. He turned on me and he said, "All right, son, who are you?" Later that day, I went AWOL from the ship. I locked myself in a hotel room, 4th and Broadway, downtown San Diego. It's called the Plaza Hotel. It's a wonderful little place. and a bottle of vodka and a shot glass, and I set it on this crickety little nightstand that's in that little hotel room, and I sat on the edge of the bed, and I stared at that bottle of vodka and the shot glass, and as I was staring at the bottle of vodka and the shot glass, I remembered the warning that the Navy doctors had given me about drinking on top of anabuse. What they had told me is, son, if you drink on top of anabuse, you're going to get one of two reactions. One reaction is you'll get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember thinking, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get. So I took one shot. Nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure. And I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in the cracked little mirror that was in this little hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going, boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. I got to tell you, this is a very sick group if you think this is funny. Normal people do not find this funny at all. In fact, I have proof of that. About 11-12 years ago, I went back to school just simply because my men's list said that I either had to pay my parents back for that bachelor's degree or I had to go get one. So when I was a couple of years sober, I went back to school, and to get one of the credits out of the way in the beginning, I just took the speech class, right? And in the first couple of days of the speech class, they just randomly started picking some of the students out from the audience and threw them up there just to see how they would do. And after about five or six people being randomly thrown up there, they pointed at me and threw me up there, and the instructor said, talk about a bizarre situation in your life. So I'm like put on the spot, so I told them about drinking on top of anabuse. They did not react like you guys. They were like, oh. There were a couple of guys in the back corner going, yeah. I've been looking for them in meetings for years now. So I took another shot. And up it came. My late sponsor, Eddie C., called this next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. Just straight up and out. Thank God it. The Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet's in the same room as the bed. I found the magic of drinking on top of anabuse, that if you don't die and you hang in there, that's the important part, you got to hang in there. You can't lightweight out halfway through. With me, if I kept drinking and kept puking and kept drinking and kept puking for between 1 and 2 hours, enough of the anabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up. And I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I already told you, I'm all right with that. I drank on top of anabuse for approximately 7 months. Whenever I could get away with it, I became extremely sick. I gained about 25 pounds on what they call alcoholic edema, simply because anabuse stops the alcohol from being processed in your system. It's almost like getting pure rubbing alcohol in through your system. It's really quite fun. And my second to my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in an area of San Diego called National City. It's kind of like South Central Los Angeles is. And apparently I was drunk out of my mind at 4 a.m. looking for a crack house. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but that morning I was jumped by three guys because they could tell that I was military and they want that military ID out there on the streets. And they just beat the living tar out of me. I woke up. It was one of those mornings where you come to and you don't know where you're at. And you start looking for hints. And whenever you start noticing right away that there's these bright lights shining on you and there's men with masks over you and they're shaking their head, you know it's been a bad night, right? And I came to on this operating table and they were doing reconstructive surgery on my face, resetting my jaw. They had to wire it shut. I had stitches all throughout my face. And here's an example of my alcoholic mind. Three to 4 days later, I'm fully medically detoxed by that time, intravenously detoxed, 4 days. No alcohol in my system whatsoever. And I'm being helped down the stairs by another man from my ship to take me back to my ship. And he's walking me down the stairs of Balboa Hospital. And I turn to him with my jaw wired shut. And I say to him, if there's any time I need a drink, it's now. See, I could not differentiate the true from the false. I could not pinpoint my drinking to the situation I was in right there. Right? I could not seem to do that. My last drunk, I was being led out of the San Diego jail by shore patrol, being brought back to the ship in handcuffs. It was one of those mornings where the handcuffs are extra tight. I hated those mornings where, you know, you're standing there and you're in handcuffs and neck muscles are not working too well. And there's official-type people standing around you deciding what to do with you. And that morning, the officer of the deck, as I was being brought up to the quarterdeck, as they were trying to decide what to do, he read this piece of paper that had been given to him earlier that morning. And he said, orders have already been processed on this loser. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or, and then he got this disgusted look on his face. He said, according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, we can't discharge this guy for alcohol-related offenses without offering him treatment first. Now, it wasn't one of these mornings where I had a moment of clarity and said, you know, today's a good day to get sober. I was forced into it. I was just turned around, still in handcuffs, and taken up to this treatment center up at the Miramar base. It's where the Top Gun pilot school is, Miramar. Our little section was called Top Drunk, is what they called us. And I was taken into a treatment center in handcuffs. Doors locked behind me, and that's when they took the handcuffs off. And that was last Sunday, 14 years ago, January 21st, 1987. Now, I didn't tell you I stayed sober from that day. I did, though, but you guys assume a lot. So anyway, everybody that showed up in the treatment center that same week, we're all going to go through this 45-day thing together. Men came from various bases. They had women in there. If you got caught smoking a cigarette out the bathroom window late at night or something, if you didn't make your bed right, or if you were caught going down to the candy machine when you weren't supposed to and Randy would turn you in, you would run about 3 miles the next day. I started to get in the best physical condition I've been in since I've been a young kid. And on about the seventh day, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no prior opinion as to what Alcoholics Anonymous was or was not. I don't remember spending much time thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew there was such a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, but you know what? As best I could tell you, I just dismissed Alcoholics Anonymous because of this. In the last few years of my drinking, there was one thing that used to just sit 1 inch behind my belly. And you know, we all have those secrets that we've had out there for years, right? You know that thing that happened that night where you know that whether you were involved or just witnessed it, you know you were fundamentally changed as a human being by being there, and you have no idea how you're going to clean your soul of that. We all have those secrets that we bring in. But there was something else that I couldn't describe to anybody, and I would have had I known how to. And that is, and this would be why I would have dismissed Alcoholics Anonymous, because I guess I knew that you guys didn't drink. I knew that I was getting into trouble when I drank. I mean, it was obvious. You know, in many situations I would be standing there and people would be yelling at me about my drinking, and I'd be saying, yeah, I know. I know it, look, yeah, yes, I see that burning car over there, yes, I know. I know that, I get out of control when I drink. But secretly inside, if I could have described it, I would have, but I didn't know it. I would have said back, but you don't know how I feel when I'm not drinking, or you wouldn't be asking me why. See, that's the thing that I always had, that when I wasn't drinking is when the insanity came. And the only way to solve that was to take a drink. And so, but I couldn't have described that to anybody. But I didn't know that I was actually describing alcoholism. Because if I didn't have that other part where I'd become restless, irritable, discontent, frustrated, full of fear, depressed, and all of these things when I wasn't drinking, well then, stopping drinking would be no problem, wouldn't it? Get in a little bit of trouble, and we'd go, huh, not for me. But I've always had to go back to drinking because of that sick feeling I would have in my belly with no booze in me. You know, they say that there's nothing worse than being out there drinking with a belly full of booze with a head full of AA? I think there is. Having a belly with no booze and no AA. There's nothing worse than that. And so they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And, you know, they piled us into about five different vans, and we all went off to different meetings. The next thing I know, I'm sitting in a meeting, something like this, and it was a participation meeting. Didn't know that there were different types of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't know that that was participation. Didn't know there were speaker meetings. Didn't know anything called a step study or a book study or anything. All I know is that they did some reading, and then probably 10 to 12 people shared for 3 to 5 minutes. And I, All I remember is sitting in the back, and this was the feeling I got. I believe I heard what any newcomer is supposed to hear in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I started to get this feeling in the back. As I heard the reading and I heard various people share, I was getting this feeling of, oh my God, they know. They know. I don't know what it is that they know that I think I know, but they know. And it's that they, in one way or another, those people in the reading, of course, we all know that, but in one way or another, I think those 10 to 12 people that shared for 3 to 5 minutes let me know that they drank like me and they thought like I did. I'll never forget this one guy describing the alcoholic mind that night. I'll never forget it the rest of my life. He got called on, he walked up to the front, it was podium participation, he introduced himself and he said one sentence and he sat down. He said, "My name's Jack, I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation." The next night we went to another meeting, and I got very confused at this meeting because everybody at that meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. And I was sitting there thinking, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? So the next morning I'm back at the treatment center. I asked the counselor that had been assigned to us. Her name was Mary Weber, a wonderful woman, non-alcoholic, but very devoted to working with alcoholics. Right? And I go, "Mary, last night in the meeting they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What on earth do they mean by that?" And she said, "Carl, it's play a little game." Now, like, remember, I'm 8 days into this thing, so I'm still, like, there's serious fog around the edge of my eyes, and I'm trying to focus in just to walk, right? And she goes, "Let's play a little game." And I go, "All right." She said, "Let's say I walked into this room and I had a tray. And on that tray I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take?" I started to drool immediately. Just, "Oh, yeah." Did I take them all? And she started to snap her fingers. "Settle down. Settle down. Settle down." When my eyes came back into focus, she said, "You can only have one. Which one would you take?" And I thought for a second, and I said, "Well, if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine." And she said, "Well, then maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now?" I said, "No." She said, "What's the problem?" And I said, "Well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of here, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. Now I'd have enough money to buy a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. That's what I would do." Now, the only reason I bring that up is that on that day I learned a very important aspect of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is sobriety dates. Very important. Need to get one if you don't have one yet. It's very important. But I have never been confused since that day on this one aspect of that, and I'm very, very grateful, because I run across people all the time that are all confused on it, and it's based upon many people, well-meaning people, trying to protect singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is absolutely vitally important to the long-term survival of Alcoholics Anonymous. Make no bones about that. I truly believe that. However, when they are protecting it, sometimes the new person doesn't hear it correctly, right? And so therefore, in my home group, quite often I run across this type of situation. I'll see some guy around my home group for a while, and I'll go up to him and say, "Hey, good to see you again. How long do you got?" And he will say something like this: "My drinking sobriety date is January 3rd. My pot clean date is May 4th, or I blew my methamphetamine date last night." Right? Juggling three different sobriety dates. It's one sobriety date. If you happen to be doing that, please keep coming back. But there's one sobriety date. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety dates. Same scenario. Saw this guy around my home group for a while, went up to him and said, "Hey, good to see you. How long do you got now?" And he said, "Well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I didn't quite know what to say to him. I thought that was actually pretty good alcoholic thinking, to tell you the truth. I think that kind of falls in the same category as being down in Mexico looking at the tequila going, "Would that affect my U.S. sobriety date?" Yes, yes, yes. Sobriety dates are international. So anyway, after 45 days, they're going to let us all out of this treatment center, and they're going to let us out on a Friday. On Wednesday, they gathered all 35 of us. They were going to get out on that Friday. They gathered us into a room. There was a lectern or a podium up front, and the biggest, meanest counselor from the place came in. He was a gunnery sergeant marine, and he came in his full dress uniform. Now, a marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive, intimidating sight. And he walked up to the front of the room, and he grabbed both sides of the podium, and he stared us all down, and we were like, and he stared at us for what seemed like forever. Like every single one of us just eyed us all down. And then he spoke. He said, "You 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. And we've been here for many, many years. And our statistics through the years have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back into long-term sobriety. But according to our statistics, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward." When he said that, if you thought it was quiet before that, you could hear a pin drop now. The only thing you could hear was me going, "Shit." Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it wasn't going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It was going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. By now, he's like the poster boy of the treatment center. I got to tell you, maybe they've changed that statement on those last couple of days, but if not, I hope they would change it to this. I would hope that that Marine or whatever person that is discharging those military men from that treatment center would say this. Out of you 35, those of you that hook up into Alcoholics Anonymous and get a sponsor, work steps, work with others, go to many, many meetings, and do everything that Alcoholics Anonymous asks you to do, 50% of you will stay sober from this day forward. Another 25% will stay sober from that day after some relapses, and the remaining 25% will show remarkable improvement. You know, that's the statistics of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't say that, though. Anyway, on this Friday afternoon, when they're letting us all out, we're standing on the front doorstep, sea bags at our feet. Various people were taken back to their bases and commands and ships and stuff through various methods, but there was a group of us that had been arrested the night before. Anybody who had been arrested the night before in a vehicle, which was me, our cars had been brought into an impound lot, so we were standing there waiting for our cars to be brought out of impound. When they brought my car out, I was so successful when I was getting loaded out there, they brought out what I like to call my Rolls Canardly. That's a car that rolls down one hill and can hardly make it up the next. It was a 68 Volkswagen, hole in the floorboard, had to push start the thing, you know, tape on the headlights and stuff. And we're standing there, sea bags at our feet, and one of the guys points to the other edge of the parking lot. There's a car slowly coming towards us, and he goes, "Hey, is that Randy in the car?" We look a little bit closer. "Yep, sure enough, that's Randy." As he got a little closer, one of the other guys says, "He's drinking already." Sure enough, as he got a little bit closer, we realized he's just finishing off a pint. Finishes off, rolls right in front of us, rolls down the window, throws the bottle right at the steps of the treatment center. Crash! We're like, damn. We look up, he's giving us all the finger, he's driving right off. I guess his name was Paco again, I don't know. Next thing that I remember is I show up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. They literally, it's podium participation, and they have a table just like they're sitting right over there on a table. And they have a mallet and a gong. And they let anybody raise their hand that they want to. However, if the person starts to snivel or carry on too long or start talking about whatever these four people don't approve of, they start whispering. And then if they keep going, the mallet comes out and bong. I never raised my hand at that meeting the whole 2 years I was in San Diego. I'm sitting in the back of this meeting, fresh out of this treatment center, and the truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink or a drug. I'm in the best physical condition I've been in since I've been a young teenager, and I've got a lot of information. If there was ever a turning point in my life, it was right there, right then, sitting in the back of that meeting. One guy operating on his primary purpose that night leaned over me and said, "Hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, and I said, "Well, you know, I just got out of this Navy treatment center, and got me. I don't know what I'm doing." And this guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. I was like, what is he getting so excited about? I didn't know it at the time. I now know that there are men in Alcoholics Anonymous that cruise around the backs of AA meeting looking for other men that don't know what they're doing. And when they land one, it's like a fisherman in Cabo San Lucas landing a big one. It's like, yeah! Right? But there was something else going on in this guy's life that particular weekend that made him especially glad to find me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for another man in his home group. So he was wondering what to do with his weekend. Homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that weekend. And this guy was just crazy over this woman all weekend. I mean, just crazy. At one point in this barrage of meetings we went to, he got called on to read chapter 5 by one of his friends. He got up there and he said, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover, people who cannot or will not completely give themselves a simple program. Usually women who are constitutionally incapable." In honor of living. His friends are, "Settle down, man. Settle down. Settle down." And in between the meetings, he'd throw me in the passenger side of his car, and he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting without even looking. Right? And he starts yelling, "Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, you gotta get his sponsor, damn her! Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, damn her!" Now, I didn't know it at the time, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that man that night in his pain was somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I was just a prop in his weekend. He had no idea that my life might be saved that night. He had no idea that I might stay sober from that day forward. He simply was, you know, he was just trying to remain reasonably sane and not do anything stupid, so he was dragging my sorry ass around. But by going to so many meetings in the same area of town, I learned something very valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't know. I saw other people that were at multiple meetings over that weekend that had time. Right? Now what I learned about how we go to meetings, now you see, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy. Right? But I saw other people that were at 2 or 3 meetings over that weekend. And what I learned, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Kind of appropriate for this weekend, isn't it? Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They'll huddle up, they'll make a plan, and they'll do one play. And then they'll huddle up, they'll make a new plan, and they'll do one play. Only in an emergency will they huddle up and then do 2 or 3 plays in a row. Well, that's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the game around here is one day without a drink or a drug, you're a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up and go, "Remember, bodily, mentally different from our fellows. Break!" And we go out there and we try a little of that, try a little of this, and we run right back in here. And we run right back in here and we huddle up and go, "Remember, bodily, mentally different from our fellows." And just before we break, some guy in the corner might go, "Wait, wait, wait, hang on. I've been here for 6 months. I'm sober, but I'm broken. I'm bored. What do I do?" Some old-timer will get up and look over his glass and say, "Get a job! Break!" And we go out there and we try a little of this. Don't rush it, though. I've got to remember that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. And I also have to remember that if I be alcoholic and you be alcoholic, I'm bodily and mentally similar to you. Now, I may be the same in many different areas to a non-alcoholic. Let's take my brother, for example. We look alike. In many, many areas, we think alike. These days. Right? But yet, when it comes to alcohol, I am fundamentally different from him. He and I could be out golfing. And on about the third or fourth hole, the drink cart comes by, he orders a beer. He has a few sips, starts concentrating on golf again, and forgets that it's there. I think that is a very bizarre relationship to alcohol. Right? That's what I have to remember, you know. But in many other areas, I'm much like him. I am related to him by blood. But at the same time, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can have a world of differences from another alcoholic in many different areas. But I got to remember that in my relationship to alcohol, I am the same. So I must do what you guys do and what the first 100 did to recover from alcoholism, no matter what I may think my other differences may be. I've got to remember that. So I get back to my ship after that weekend, 18 meetings, and the one other recovering alcoholic on my ship was waiting for me. Right? There's one other guy, and he was all excited that this new guy was getting out of treatment. He had the same attitude that other guy had that ran across me, and he came down and found me, and He said, "We're going to a meeting tonight." And he started to drag me to meeting after meeting after meeting. We're going to lots of meetings, and he just started to really, really work with me and go to lots and lots of meetings. And when I was about 6 months sober, the ship had to go out to sea, and so he told me, Bob, my first sponsor, he just became my first sponsor, he said, "Meet me in the aft end of the ship every night at 6:30. And so I would, first night I get down there, and he had that blue book in his hands, and he tossed it down on the table in there, and he said, "We've been to lots of meetings together. Have you read it?" And I said, "Well, you know, there's like how it works, we antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something." There I was, 6 months sober, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and any one of you could have walked up to me at that point and said, "Carl, your life depends on the answer to this question," and it would have. What does it mean to be powerless over alcohol that your life had become unmanageable? At that point, I would have stuttered and stammered and talked to you about crazy things I did while drinking, and that's what makes me powerless over alcohol. And you know what? I would have been totally missing the boat. I have to get into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous if I have any desire of staying here long term. For the first reason is I got to know what's wrong with me. I got to understand allergy to the body, obsession to the mind. I got to understand that I'm powerless when I drink alcohol, but equally important, I'm powerless when I am not drinking. Right? And I'm in this ultimate catch-22. I cannot drink successfully. I cannot not drink successfully. I've got to understand that. If I don't understand it, why would I go anywhere near the rest of the steps? If I don't understand that I'm in a fatal malady that no human power can conquer, you know. And he opened up that book that night, and he started reading. Then he handed it over to me, and I started reading, and he tricked me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got back from 21 days at sea, I had this list of amends that I didn't like at all. Never met when I was leaving San Diego on that ship. I was not meaning to come back with this list. And by taking this, when I took the steps the first time, this is going to sound bizarre, but I'll explain myself, that I did not have the type of spiritual awakening that I believe is available in Alcoholics Anonymous when I took the steps myself. What happened to me was, I had what the book calls the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I did not get what is promised in Alcoholics Anonymous, or I should say, available in Alcoholics Anonymous, until I started to do for others what had been done for me. That's where the real magic is. Right? Now, the very first time, and one alcoholic working with another is where the whole ball of wax is. And my very first experience with that, it's one of the greatest experiences of my sobriety. It was a few months later. I was about maybe 8 or 9 months sober, and our ship was in Victoria, Canada. And my first sponsor, Bob, and I, whenever we'd pull into port for a number of days, we would rent a hotel room together, and then we would go out to meetings whenever we could, and, you know, just so we could sleep off the ship. And this one night, we had been at the AA meeting. Bob went back a little bit earlier. I went out with the local AAers for some coffee or to do whatever. I don't remember, but I came back to the hotel room, and there's Bob with this guy named Blair, who is absolutely drunk out of his mind, obviously in a blackout, can barely sit up, and Bob has the big book out and is reading to him. Now, I look at this scene, and in my 9 months, I decide that this is a crazy situation. Blair won't get anything out of this. Bob is wasting his time. What is he doing? So I just go over to my bed over on the other side of the room, turn out the light on my side, roll over, and go to sleep. Hear nothing about it for a couple of weeks. We're back down in San Diego. It's 3 a.m. in the morning, and all of a sudden on my rack, there's, "Carl, wake up! It's Bob! Wake up!" I'm like, what? He goes, "Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. Come on, we're going to get him." And I'm thinking, what on earth? Well, apparently, sometime in the middle of the night that night, Blair had decided, screw it, and he's just going to go jump off the Coronado Bridge. It's a big, big bridge down there in San Diego. But at the top of the Coronado Bridge, there's this suicide hotline telephone. I call it the chicken out phone, if you change your mind, right? And apparently, Blair had gotten up there and gotten onto that suicide hotline phone. And had called, and of course, suicide hotline and the fire department's on the other end. And apparently this is what Blair had said to them. "I will only talk to Bob W." So the fire department is saying, "Now who's Bob W?" Blair is saying, "It's anonymous." I can just see that from the fire department going. Well, anyway, they somehow pried out of him what ship he was from, and so they called down to our ship, and my first sponsor, Bob, did not guard his own anonymity on the ship for the sole purpose of being available to help another alcoholic whenever possible. He would guard anybody else's anonymity, but he didn't guard his own so that he could help. And sure enough, the officer of the deck knew who Bob W. was, right? Even they sometimes even teased him about being Mr. 12-step, you know, silly teasing like that. But he would shirk it off because he knew he needed to be there for another alcoholic. And sure enough, the officer of the deck, when he got the call, said, "Sure, we know who Bob is." And they went down and got him. Bob came down and woke me up, and that's where it was, "We're going down to get Blair." So we get into Bob's car, and we're driving down to the Coronado Bridge, and Bob says, "Grab the big book out of the glove box. Start reworking with others." So I open it up, and it says, "Well, see your man alone if possible." Well, he's pretty alone up there, isn't he? Yeah. Place this book where he might, well, you know what, it'll fall in the water if we do that. So Bob says, "Oh, forget it. Just throw it in there. We're going to wing it." So we get down there, and we get down there, and everything the San Diego community has to offer for this type of situation is there. There are fire trucks, there are paramedics, there are psychiatrists, everybody's there. And we walk up to this scene, and the fire chief looks at us and says, "Are you Bob W.?" He goes, "Yep." He goes, "Well, we've been trying for hours to get him down, and he won't budge, and he says he'll only talk to you." So he hands Bob the little phone thing, the portable phone thing, and Bob goes, "Blair?" And you can hear this voice on the other end, "Is that you, Bob?" And Bob says, "Yes, Blair, it's me. Now get the hell down from that bridge." And you hear on the other end, "Okay." One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like nobody else can. So anyway, when I'm 2 years sober, I'm getting out of the Navy with an honorable discharge. An amazing, amazing thing. First thing I had ever accomplished in my life since getting between Cub Scouts and Weeblos. Literally the first time I think I'd ever accomplished. I got out of the Navy with an honorable discharge, and through having to make amends and having a sponsor and his sponsor, they had kept me real poor. I had a Navy paycheck every 2 weeks, and all of it was going to try to get me even with society financially. There was lots of other amends to be made, but I mean, I was still dead broke at 2 years sober, getting out of the Navy, and everything. I was still push starting that same damn Volkswagen. Had everything I owned in that car, and I was puttering on up to the Los Angeles area to go to school simply because the amends said I had to go to school, right, to pay my parents back. And I was pulling on up, and my school was in this area of San Gabriel Valley, and I went and I checked in with the school counselor, and it was about 11:30, so I called AA Central office and asked them where a noon meeting was. And I was as I was driving along, I was thinking, you know what? I'm 2 years sober. I need a life. As I'm puttering along, getting more restless, zero and discontent. Yeah. Well, you know what? I got to work. I got to go to school, and I'll stop by some meetings when I get a chance. You know, but I'm going to go get a life because I've heard, I'm 2 years sober. I've heard people in AA talking about having a life. I'm going to go get one of those, and then I'll stop by AA when convenient. And I was about ready to make a fatal decision as an alcoholic. And I pulled into a noon meeting in Covina, and that's where I met the man who was to be my sponsor until he died 2 years ago on March 14th, Eddie C. He was 47 years sober when he died. And I met him when he had 35 years. And I came into that noon meeting. First thing that irked me about where this noon meeting was is that the parking lot was flat. One of the tools for living I had, having to push start your car for so long, is that I like meetings where there was a little bit of an incline that you could park on. Right? And I go into that meeting and I meet Eddie. He was making coffee at this noon meeting. 35 years sober, and he walked up to me, and it was a little bit early, so he sat down next to me, and I tried to tell him my plan, that I was going to go to school, I was going to work, and I'll stop by some meetings. I'm glad to know where some meetings are in this area. I don't quite know where I'm going to live yet, but I'm glad that I know where the meetings are, and I'll see you once in a while. And I was trying to explain this to him, and he just started to chuckle the way he did in his very kind but very direct way. And he said, "Son, those are wonderful things for a young man recovering from alcoholism. School, work, great, but those are the things we do in between meetings." Oh, what he was really telling me, he was giving me one of the most profound messages that has held me here. Because if I would have gone on my plan, I would not be here tonight standing in front of you 14 years clean and sober. What he was really teaching me is that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world. So many of my friends have tried to live out in the world and visit Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient, and they are not here anymore. Right? Now, when I say live in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't mean that you have to be at the morning meeting, the noon meeting, the 5 o'clock meeting, the 7 o'clock meeting, the 9 o'clock meeting, and the Midnight Madness meeting, and get a job at the local Alano Club. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a spiritual centeredness of knowing who and what I am and what my dilemma is and what my plan of action to bring about the solution in my life is. And that's got to come first above everything. I've got to have that first. And by doing that, my life has become something that I didn't even know was available to a guy like me. I can tell you this one little story, and that will kind of sum up everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. About 6 months ago, I was asked to go down and give a talk in this town called Nogales, Arizona. It was going to be one of those campouts, and I've been to those before, and I always say yes whenever I possibly can, but I know that, you know, when I get there, they're going to show me this little pup tent on the side where these big semis are rolling by in the middle of the night, and they're going to point to this trailer that I can go to the bathroom in. It's going to be a wonderful weekend, I know. Right? But but I said yes, and about a few days, I was going to leave on a Friday, and on earlier that week, I called my mother up in Seattle to tell her that, you know, I have no idea whether Nogales, Arizona, whether my pager is going to work whenever I think I might be out of pager range, because there's these various pockets through the country where my pager goes dead. It's really quite irritating. But, so I was going to tell my mom, and as always, if I possibly might be out of pager range, that I tell her that I'm going to be out of pager range. So I called her, and I told her I was going to go to Nogales, Arizona. And she goes, "Hey, Don and Leona live just north of Nogales, Arizona. Why don't you give them a call, and maybe you can stop by and see them?" And I had to ask my mom, "Can you remind me who Don and Leona are?" And she reminded me, oh yes. I hadn't seen them since I was a young little kid. Don was the best man at my father's and mother's wedding some 50 years before that. So I called up Don, and I said I was going to be in Nogales, and would he like to get together for lunch or something? He said, "Hey, do you like to golf?" And I said, "Well, I love to golf. In fact, I'm obsessed with golf." He said, "Bring your clubs. We'll go out to my country club, and we'll play a round of golf, and we'll chat." So I get there, and I got my golf clubs, and we go out golfing, and we're walking along. And as we're going along, Don starts asking me very specific, pertinent questions about my life. And the more he asks, the more dumbfounded I am. I mean, he knew everything about my life. He was saying he knew exactly what school I had graduated from, what my bachelor's degree was in, what companies I had been with. He knows about the recovery homes I'm associated with, this foundation I'm with, and the work I do with the court and the probation system. And he was just asking very specific, pertinent questions. And by the fourth hole, I turned to him and I go, "Don, how on earth do you know all this stuff about my life?" And he said, "Well, Carl, two reasons. First reason is, before your father died back in 1996, he was always talking about how proud he was of you and your life." Now, I knew that. My father had told me numerous times when I was sober how proud he was. But this next thing that he said absolutely floored me, and I could barely keep golfing. He said, "And other than your father telling me, every year, I get the Christmas letter." Like, yes! Finally! God bless. Good night.